As we began this study, we noted that there are at least two, I think, improper ways of understanding the relationship between the church and the individual. Some people would suggest that whatever the individual can do, the church is also obligated to do. And other people would suggest that whatever the church is not authorized to do, the individual is not authorized to do. Both of those approaches, I think, are wrong. But there is, I think, a better approach, and that is to say that whatever the individual Christian is authorized or even sometimes required to do as an individual, the church, as the church, is not authorized to do. And we looked at how Christianity impacts all of the relationships that we as individuals are involved in. Of course, we have a relationship with the church. That's undeniable. We have a relationship as individuals to the community. But when we say that we have an individual, that we as individuals have a relationship to the community, that's not the same as saying that the church then acquires a relationship to the community. You can't, I've referred to that as throwing a skip pass. You can't make that conclusion. The individual has a relationship to the church, the individual has a relationship to the community, but to say that the church has a relationship to the community is without merit. We talked about how we as individuals have a relationship to business enterprises that we may be involved in. We may be the owner, we may be an employee, we may be a farmer with people that work for us. Whatever that relationship is, we have an individual responsibility and an individual relationship to the business community that's around us. We have an individual relationship to our homes. And we as individuals have responsibilities that we discharge in our homes. We have an individual responsibility to government. And again, that's not to say that churches have a relationship to government just because individuals have a relationship to government. Now that gets muddied up, and a lot of people assume that the church has a relationship to government when that can't be shown from the New Testament scriptures. And as we were looking at all of this, Bob mentioned, you know, we ought to think about the fact that the individual Christian has a God-designed relationship with the earth, with the world that's around us. And when I say world, I'm not talking about the people, I'm talking about the globe. We have an individual responsibility to manage what goes on in the environment. But again, that's not to say that the church acquires a responsibility to manage what goes on in the environment. That's not something that I had considered until Bob mentioned it. And then I began to consider what the Bible says about the individual and his relationship to the world around him. So I started all the way back in Genesis. Now, this is a, I don't want to say a dangerous thing, but what we're doing is we're going back beyond the time that the church existed. So we can't draw as many conclusions about the relationship between the church and the world because the church wasn't even conceived at this point. We can't even say that the old nation of Israel had been conceived at this point. At this point, there was only the individual. So bear that in mind as we look at these passages, because it makes it a little bit more difficult to draw the conclusions that we've drawn about churches and individuals and their relationship to the various aspects of our lives. But let's look at at Genesis 1. And can I get someone to read verses 26 through 28? This is at the very beginning, creation.
And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heaven, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth.
So what do we see here? Man was supposed to have a relationship with the rest of creation. How would you describe that relationship?
In a manner of speaking, we were to be husbandmen over God's creation.
Okay. That's an unusual word. That's not a word that we would typically use very often. What do you mean by a husbandman?
Well, it mentions of one or two of the kings that they loved husbandry. And this was, I think, basically raising cattle.
I think that's right. That's not a word that I have done any research about, but I do know that that's a way that that word is used often, as animal husbandry.
There was also, I'm not sure if you got it up there, that Adam and Eve were to tend the garden.
Okay.
And that's plants.
Okay. Somebody want to read Genesis 2 at verse 15?
And the Lord took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it.
Okay. To cultivate it and keep it. And to use it for food, by the way, as well. I didn't read far enough to make that point, but that's in verse 16 and following there in that passage, in that paragraph. The Lord commanded the man, saying, you may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. But man had the ability or the responsibility to tend to the garden and to use it for his benefit, to eat of the tree, the trees of the garden. What else can you say? Yeah, Kim.
Well, my version of verse 15 is, it says, let's see, and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it.
Okay.
And I think that's what husbandry is taking care of. Mm-hmm. So it is, and so we're to take care of the planet. When we say world and earth, we also mean the people. But I think he gave us, when you go back to mankind, I think, when you go back to those verses that you read earlier, down through verse 27, if you go on and read 28 through 30, it really talks about why he gave them the garden. He gave that as a free gift for what these people needed. And then a few verses later, he says, take care of it. I'm giving you this gift to take care of it. So I think we need to view the planet as a gift that God has given to us to care for.
Okay. Yeah, Carol?
I have a question. In Genesis 1:26, and then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky, over the cattle and over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. God, when he created the earth, cared for the animals in the creation. And in Psalms or Proverbs, it says that the birds don't have to toil. So he takes care of the animals. And he made them in the image of us, in the image of God. And in the image of God, is that one of the things that he gave us that the Godhead had done?
Well, help me out. What does anybody else see? Is this part of man having the image of God? We typically think about that in terms of a spirit, okay? But it may be broader than that. Yeah, Bob?
Well, to me, the idea of the husbandry and the keeping has a certain idea of morality to it. Mm-hmm. That we have a responsibility to care for things the way God would.
Okay.
And he loves his creation. He loves his people. And he cares for them, provides for them, and protects them. And in my personal opinion, we should have that sort of attitude toward animals and toward our earth. And, you know, this idea of going in and using up a resource until it's totally gone and then walk away as if there's no further responsibility. That doesn't set well with me.
Right. Right. That's abusing the relationship that we have instead of using it for our benefit and for the benefit of the creature.
Same age.
Okay. I grew up in Kentucky, and I don't know if you've ever seen strip mining, but it's a terrible thing to do to the land. They go in and they basically strip the top layer of overburden off of the coal seam. They pile it up into what they call slag heaps. And there are so many heavy metals in that that when it rains, the rain that percolates down through that is toxic. And so then they go in and they mine the coal. They just dig out the coal and they leave a big pit. And it's usually right next, or a big hole, and it's usually right next to the slag heap, and the rainwater from the slag heap runs into the pit, the old mining pit, and it's poison. Animals die when they get into that water. And, you know, dummy me, I was a kid, and my grandparents always told me, don't go swimming in the strip pits, but that didn't stop me. You know, I swam in the strip pits.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I lived to tell about it. It's not the best. I mean, I'm not bragging about myself. I'm not very bright to go do that.
You're just a kid.
When there are dead animals laying around the edge of the strip pit.
Well,
okay.
That explains a lot now.
Okay. Yeah, that explains it. Now, I will say this. My other grandparents, my grandfather was a farmer. And raised cattle, raised pigs, but he never abused them. Okay? He raised them, sent them to market, they were slaughtered, and they became food. But he never abused them. In fact, he treated them well. And the reason that he treated them well was that they would do better if he treated them well. Yeah, Carol.
I just heard yesterday, and I have absolutely no idea whether it's true or not, but this restaurateur, or actually a supermarket thing, they buy tuna from Japan. And before they kill the tuna on the boat, they supposedly stroke the tuna, and supposedly the tuna tastes different because they stroke the tuna before they kill it. I don't know if that's true.
I don't know. Hey, I went fishing with guys that kissed salmon on the nose when they caught them. Oh, you know, don't ask me about that kind of stuff. Yeah, somebody else had their hand up, and I missed it. I don't want to miss anybody. But to say that man has dominion over the animals is not to say that man mistreats the animals any more than a man who has the rule over his wife is entitled to mistreat his wife. Man has dominion over the animals, but that dominion over the animals entails taking care of the animals, taking care of the plants. We don't think about plants as having feeling, but I understand if you sing to plants, they do better. I probably am singing the wrong song to my plants because all of them die. I'm not very good at taking care of plants. Well, let's look at Psalms 24. And again, I would remind you that this is Old Testament. So this is not going to have much bearing on the relationship between the church and the environment. It really can't because the church hadn't been established. But it is indicative, I think. The Psalms and Proverbs, in particular in the Old Testament, sort of speak about the nature of God. And I don't think the nature of God, his characteristics, change based on the covenant that we're living under. And Lenny's going to talk about the characteristics of God in the next class that Lenny teaches on Wednesday night. So the character of God stays constant. And that has a lot to mean, or a lot of meaning for us, because the character of Jesus that we saw when he was here is the same character that he has now that he's in heaven. So he had compassion on people when he was here. He's going to have compassion on people from heaven. So, yeah, Bill.
One point I think I can't ignore. God didn't create all of this for us to destroy it.
Okay. Good point. One that we have to be aware of. But he did create it for us to use it. Okay. And there, I have talked to some people that were vegans, and they would say, God didn't make animals for you to eat them. Well, he did. But that's not abuse. That's use. Let's look at Psalms 24. In verse 1. Somebody want to read that?
The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell in therein.
Okay. The reason that I included that passage is I think it just says, if the earth belongs to God, not you. The earth belongs to God. So treat it like it belongs to God. Other comments about that particular passage?
He happens to include people in that, too.
Okay.
In scripture.
Okay. You're absolutely correct. People belong to God. Don't abuse people. It's not to say that you can't hire somebody and pay them a wage and expect them to do a job, but you do not abuse them. Okay, and then there's this, I ran across this passage in the book of Leviticus. And this particular passage is dealing with the ancestral land that was given to each of the 12 tribes in the children of Israel. And you understand that they were not to sell that land permanently to anyone else. When it was given to that tribe, it was supposed to stay with that tribe. They could sell it, but what happened on the 50th year was it reverted to its original owners. And it, you know, I was doing a lot of reading about this, and somebody said that's the way that God dealt with the accumulation of generational wealth. Every 50th year, it reverts to its original owners. So you can't build a family empire that slowly begins to acquire all of the means of production, because every 50 years, you disrupt that and things go back to the way that they were in the beginning. Now, this is a statement that's made about land that existed in the old covenant. I understand that. And it's going to have limited applicability to the land that we might own today. It's a little bit different. God doesn't say that every 50 years, all land reverts to its original owners today. But somebody want to read Leviticus 25, verse 23?
The land must not be sold permanently because the land is mine, and you are but aliens and my tenants.
What do you see?
Well, God gave them this gift of the land, but he kind of retains ownership.
Okay.
Even though they own it, you know, that, you know, it's not like they, you know, and they're tenants, they're caretakers, they're the caretakers of the property, in a sense.
Okay. Yeah, Carol?
When you mentioned the accumulation of wealth, it also gives people an opportunity to try again to be successful. The person who's had bad luck with spouses dying or children dying and whatever, it also gives them another, a clean slate to go, and not something that they're bound by for everybody's life.
Yeah. Yeah. And that can happen. I mean, it's something that we have to be aware of. Medical issues can be so severe that you expend all of your resources. You sell land. You do everything you can to pay for those medical expenses. And because you have essentially impoverished yourself, you have, in effect, impoverished your children, because they're not going to inherit any land. They're not going to inherit any resources. And I'm not going to say that it's improper for someone to go into debt to pay for medical expenses. I'm not going to go there. But I do think that there's something to be said for this. Something to think about. Now, let it be said that we have provisions in our country that I think are wise provisions. You can declare bankruptcy and your debt can be discharged. And in bankruptcy, you can keep as your personal asset your dwelling. So that our country provides for people who have fallen on hard times so that they are not completely impoverished. In the Old Testament, it was common for people to sell themselves into slavery or to become voluntary slaves of other Israelites, but they were free every 7 years. Okay. Now they could choose to stay, but they were free. So it's kind of a safeguard that God puts on this. What do you see in the idea of being a tenant?
What? Tenant.
Yeah, what do you see in that relationship?
Well, tenants have a responsibility to maintain what they are tenants of.
Okay.
They should not be abusing it. They should be keeping it up.
Okay. That's true. I have rental property, and my tenants have been great about maintaining the rental property. Now, I'm ultimately responsible for it, but they cannot destroy it. They water the grass. They keep the grass cut. They take care of the plants on the property that I own. And that's what a tenant does. And I think there's a sense in which we are, I know there was a sense in which the Israelites were tenants on God's property. But like Kim said, it's ultimately owned by God, and he's giving it to them for their use. Yeah, Carol.
It makes me think of the parable of the vineyard, where the owner keeps going back to get the payment, and it's way off in left field, but because we are the tenants, we owe God for what we are getting from the use of this earth, he's given us.
Right, Kim?
The term tenant to me, or tenancy, also implies a temporary nature, you know, and so I think, because he says you're aliens, you're strangers, you don't own this, this isn't yours, this is mine, and I'm letting you come here, I'm letting you care for it and take care of it and reside here, but it's only temporary, you'll move on. And meaning, I think for us, if I'm going to apply it to me, I'm just a tenant here, this is temporary for me, this is a part of my existence.
Okay. Yeah, Bill.
A couple of things. When it says that this is God's property, that's a huge responsibility. We need to take care of it because it's for the Creator. We can't give secondhand treatment. And another thing was, when it came to people who were servants or bondservants, and I don't remember clearly about captives from other nations, they were not to be treated with rigor, which means beaten on.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. This person might be your slave, but you're to treat him with respect. Okay? That doesn't mean that you can't be a slave. It just means that masters have a responsibility to treat you with respect. Now, Peter does say, you have a responsibility even to a master who doesn't treat you with respect. So the fact that somebody else abuses their relationship doesn't give you the right to then abuse back. Yeah, Carol.
When under the Old Testament, when God gave them the promised land, he actually gave it to them. And although we buy our houses now, our property and the possessions, like Kim says, we still are just stewards of the gifts that God is giving us. And we can maybe get in the way of ourselves by thinking, well, I bought this myself, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's awful subject.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's some validity to that. Yeah, Bill?
There's scripture you can't find in Proverbs that mentions the compassion or whatever of the fool is cruel toward their animals. I kind of thumbed through and I couldn't find it. But cruelty is spoken of towards living things as a bad thing.
Okay. Now, that's an interesting point. We think of the earth as being an inanimate object. Okay, there's a really interesting passage in Romans, the 8th chapter, beginning at verse 19. And I realize that this is, in a sense, poetic language. I realize that he's not saying that the earth is alive. And goodness only knows, we've seen that play out in people suing on behalf of the Willamette River, as if the Willamette River was an individual that had been wronged. I don't believe that that's the case. I think that's an overstatement of what we're looking at here. But can I get somebody to read Romans 8, 19 through 22? And remember, this is, in a sense, a poetic expression of just how bad we have become. Romans 8, 19 through 22.
For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, and hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time.
Okay. So the earth is spoken of here almost as a person. Yeah.
Well, I've got a note here underlined the word creation, and it's K-T-I-T-S, and it means people. I don't know if that might change the situation. I don't remember the lesson at all, but it could be talking about the people rather than the earth.
Okay. I didn't look at that. That might be something that I need to look at. But at what point was the earth made hostile to man?
When man corrupted.
When man sinned.
When he turned against God.
Right. The earth brings forth weeds. It had not done that before. It had yielded up its fruit for man. And I, again, kind of poetic language, I realize that, but it seems like the earth wanted to cooperate with man, to feed the man. And now there's animosity that exists between man and the earth. And trust me, the piece of dirt that I own in Eugene is absolutely inimical to my efforts to make it pretty. It does everything it can to bring forth weeds. So, again, I'm not sure that this is a passage that absolutely refers to that. The Paul says in another place, the rocks cry out. So I just take it with a grain of salt. Yeah, Kim.
Well, I don't know enough about this to know, but my thought is that when he talks about the creation, I think it's both animate and inanimate, because later he distinguishes between creation and man as these verses read on.
Yeah.
So I think that he's talking about in totality everything that he's created, mm-hmm. man included. But there's a distinction later as he's talking about we also wait eagerly in addition to this creation, whatever this creation is. So I think it's also including inanimate objects. That's my understanding of this verse, but I haven't done a deep dive either.
Yeah, I didn't look at the etymology of the term creation. Something that I can do. I just didn't do it. Yeah.
I only mentioned the one, but if I read verse 19, it says the anxious longing of the creation, which is people, waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God, and sons of God is underlined, and it's the adopted adoption of Christians or of all nations, basically.
Right.
So I don't know if that helps any or well, not.
I think it's absolutely true that the world, all people, look forward to revealing the sons of God. Okay? That's undeniable. But I think there may be a sense in which even the earth is liberated from this animosity.
The earth cried out in pain in or cried out in Genesis when God withdrew and the weeds and the seeds and the other things. So the comparison there may be 100% correct. I don't know, but I
yeah, it's just something to think about. And again, I haven't explored this as completely as I probably should have. It just never occurred to me to think about this, and it is something that we need to think about. Ted.
Along those lines, we see also in Genesis that when Cain killed Abel, the earth cried out because of his blood.
Yeah.
I think that we don't understand the relationship that God has with this creation. God understands all of his creation. We understand each other, but we have scientists trying to learn what whale speech is and dolphin speech. Trust me, God understands his creation. He understands all of it because he made it. He knows what it's about.
Right.
He knows how needed it is.
Right.
So the fact that we see that we don't have a very good relationship with the creation means that because we don't understand it. And that's what he tells us. You can look around you and see God in all of creation because God created.
Yeah, that's true. And it's not just the earth, it's the stars, the heavens. I don't think we ought to be abusing other planets. If we find other planets and we get there and our purpose is not to just go to another planet and strip mine it. That's not the goal. Now, I don't think that that's the realm in which the church ought to be involved. And there are a lot of people that would suggest that the church should be involved in ecology, that the church ought to be involved in supporting Earth Day, those kinds of things. The church ought to speak out about the abuse of the planet. I don't think that's the responsibility of the church. I think it is the responsibility of us as individual Christians. But again, it's not laid out as clearly as I think some other things are. So I struggle a little bit with understanding this. But it's a good discussion, and I think it's one that we need to have, and it's a discussion that we need to reflect on. Any other comments in closing? Yeah, Carol.
Well, if we took your diagram there and reverse the Christian and put the church in the center. The church has the responsibility to the environment would be that they don't contaminate it. They don't throw their trash out. So they're not going to be a very effective church if they, you know, they take care of what they're supposed to with the laws. The same thing with the community. You follow the laws that the community does, like we did with COVID, but you don't break the laws. If you have business with a business, you pay your bills. I mean, and if you have something with a home, there's so many things, but if there's something that happens in a home, we rally. And so in an entirely different way than how the Christian has a relationship, the church only has a relationship with this environment and the businesses and stuff. In the way that God says we are to, the church is to follow authority. And so unless it
I'm not sure that the church has ever given that charge. Individuals are, but I'm not sure that the church is ever given that responsibility. Church is never treated as an individual. And it's, you know, that it's interesting to think about the ways that the church began to be treated as an individual when the church began to own property as an entity. Then the church begins to be treated as if it's an individual, and it's not. So
no, but during COVID, the church had to do different things as a church.
I don't know if the church had to do it or we as individuals had to do it.
Well, the elders decided
that we as individuals should accomplish this task in a particular way.
Okay, so then the only responsibility that the church has to the community is to spread the gospel.
Well, it's really not a responsibility of the church to the community. It's a responsibility of the church to perfect the saints so that the saints can go out and do that.
Okay.
Okay. So that's the way I understand it. That's my approach. That the individual has the responsibility, the church has a responsibility to prepare the individual to go out and discharge their responsibility. Okay? And this, some people would say I'm straining at a gnat, but in my mind, that makes sense. Just as the individual has a responsibility to care for his family, the church has a responsibility to teach the individual to care for his family. If the individual doesn't care for his family, that doesn't say it. The responsibility devolves onto the church. It doesn't. The church has a responsibility to teach the individual to care for his family.
Except for a widow indeed?
Well, if you have widows indeed, yes. Okay? There are special cases. And we'll talk a little bit about that. That's the next part of our discussion. What happens when the individuals don't do what they're supposed to do relative to all of the parts of their relationship? Does the church take that over and say, I'll take care of it then? That's the mistake that I think we've made in many cases. Okay? So, good discussion. Thank you for bearing with me and putting up with my inability to say that I understand this very well. Thank you for helping me to understand it. And I think it's an important thing for us to understand.